Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hey folks, welcome to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway is the local store here in Des Moines that brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. With 23 years in the business of real estate, Joe is also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. And we were just delighted this past week to have Alton, a great Irish music group, perform here in Des Moines. Hey, for my first guest today is Kevin O'Hara. He's an author. He's also retired a few years back from 30 years as a psych nurse. He lives in Western Massachusetts. He's written 3 books. I read all of them. One of them I like so much, I read it twice. they're all excellent works. And with St. Patrick's Week, yes, we get a whole week these days, coming up, I want to talk with Kevin a little bit about his experience being a first-generation Irish-American living in Western Mass. And I was a little bit behind you. You're, I think, 9 years older than me, Kevin. I was a second-generation Irish-American growing up on the other side of the state. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me again, Ed.
Yeah. Hey, so I got done reading your book, A Lucky Irish Lad, and there were places that literally had me in stitches. And the one I want to talk about to kick it off here is, let's just call it your brush with near sainthood. I mean, there's Lourdes, there's Fatima, there's Knock in Ireland, holy shrines to the Blessed Virgin Mary, because some children, and children and other, and in some cases adults, had visionary experiences. And that was almost you. You were almost Kevin of Pittsfield.
I came really close, for a moment there, actually for a year or two there. I thought the Blessed Mother was going to appear before me. And it all started on one of her feast days, Feast of Assumption, August 15th. I was at Mass. It was a holy day of obligation. I was 10 years of age, and I was up at the altar. Back then, this was before Vatican II, so the priest would turn away from people. They celebrated Mass looking away from the congregation, not looking in front like they are today. And, well, he came around with communion, and I'll call him Father Jameson, but his real name was Father Ahern, and he had what my dad used to call the Irish jigs. He was tremulous. and to catch the host that he offered was tricky. As the altar boy used to say, it was like trying to catch a knuckleballers, or a butterfly on your tongue. And this particular, it was a Thursday, I think, or Friday, the communion, the host, the Eucharist caught just a lower lip of my lower lip, so, and just hung there, and God forgive me, like Jimmy Dean and, a cigarette.
So his hand was so shaky.
Then, of course,
His hand was shaky. It was that shaky that you didn't know whether the host was going to land in your tongue or, in this case, on your lip.
Right. In fact, people going up to him at communion, the men would loosen their ties and the top button, and others would stretch out their necks because they knew. Oftentimes, two heads would knock together going for the same host. That's how tremulous he was, right?
Because people are kneeling.
My dad called it the Irish jigs because
great,
he was
yeah.
very fond.
And people are kneeling down. This is back in the day when the Mass was in Latin. People would kneel at the altar. The altar boy held a little plate underneath your chin. Yeah.
Right.
Crazy.
And Pan, and so therefore I was left, and you would never touch the host back then. Not even the holiest nun could hold a host. And so I was struggling with it, and I was the last there. I was in the middle aisle, like at the altar, and everybody watching me, the priest turning back. So I suppose some people might have been thinking I had epilepsy or something, but nobody came to my rescue. And I finally secured the host on my tongue. And just as the priest looked back to give the last blessing for the Mass, I secured the host and I went back to my seat. And the parishioners, which was shocking to me, looked at me in awe because they thought I had an apparition to Mary, the Blessed Mother.
And that's because your head was moving to try to get the host off your lip into your...
Exactly.
But they couldn't see it. They all they saw was the back of your head. They couldn't see what you were doing with your tongue.
Exactly. So, I mean, and then I came down and it was just looks of awe and admiration. In fact, one woman reached out and grabbed my pant off as I walked. And I was just so bothered by it all. I just walked right out to church, came home and started bawling my eyes out. By that time, the phone was ringing off the hook. Father Jameson had called, a few other people had called, wondering if I truly had an apparition. And of course, I'm 10 years of age, and this is the most fame I've ever had in my life, right? And my sister Mary had heard about it as well before I got home from Mass. It was like a 30-minute walk from Mass back to the house. And she basically genuflected when she saw me, right? I like that, right? So anyways, I had to come up clean, but I didn't quite know how. And Father Ahern, as his name was, said, "Mr. O'Hara, perhaps it's a prelude, because Mary, if she appeared to you suddenly, it might be just too shocked for the system. So she'd give you little clues beforehand, right?"
So he was hoping that you would actually have this experience.
Oh yeah, the whole parish did.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I was the guy, right?
Right.
I mean, here's a poor little 10-year-old who couldn't make the little league, you know, and all of a sudden I've got sainthood in my hands, right? So either way, it was a prelude, and I like that. And so I likened it to when you turn on a light and the bulb would just go pop, you know. So that's how I explained it. And, of course, some kids believed me, and many kids, there were a few in the schoolyard who did. They called me Francisco, who was one of the hopeful visionaries years ago who never saw Mary, but his sister did.
That was in Fatima, in Portugal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, in Fatima. Yeah. And some would make fun of me, and others actually believed me, and they'd ask me questions. And one said, "Are you going to ask the Blessed Mother that you could make the Little League this year?" These kind of things, right? And of course, I played along with it for a while. Again, it's notoriety, it's celebrity to a guy who had absolutely nothing at that time. And I'd look up at the sky and see Mary in the clouds, more or less, right? And I set up a little shrine near the footbridge, about an eighth of a mile from our house. Beautiful footbridge, actually. It's now dismantling years. It used to belong to an old mill. But I had a little statue of Mary about an inch and a half high that kept falling from the my father's car that he had up on the dashboard with the little magnet. So I took that and wedged it into a small sampling maple tree, and I used to know there's where Mary would come to me. But I'm still waiting for her, and who knows, maybe someday she'll come around.
So at first you were in church after the experience, after wrestling with the host, you were embarrassed. And that's why you kind of fled home, correct?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, but especially with the looks the parishioners were given to me, you know?
But then after you started realizing that, hey, maybe there's some fame and fortune to be had with this, maybe you believe there was the potential for an actual vision that could be the equivalent of what was experienced at Fatima and Lourdes and Knock.
Yeah, well, it nudged me enough to think that maybe I had been a chosen one, right? Yeah. And, of course, my mother consoled me, you know, because I came up with the truth. I told my brother Dermot and a few other folks, you know, my family members, that it was really the host that I was trying, and I had never caught a glimpse of Mary, you know. But still, I mean, kids in the schoolyard wouldn't forget it. And then on December 8th, another holy day of obligation, Immaculate Conception, kids were, well, the parish was there hoping that as I went to communion at this time, another celebration for Mary, that something would happen there again. And of course, I let the whole parish down. I came. It was a long walk back to my seat, because I caught the hose properly. It was a young curate named Father Lowen, who didn't have the shakes that Father Hearn had, right? So anyways, I played my cards as long as I could, and of course, eventually, it was more or less forgotten. And there you go.
But you didn't. So you didn't achieve sainthood, but you did. You did end up in a saintly line of work. You were a psych nurse at a hospital in Pittsfield. And you wrote a book about that as well.
Yeah, and that was nice. And, you know, a lot of that stems from my donkey walk. I mean, I had been a nurse for 3 or 4 years beforehand as a psych nurse. And then I went on my donkey tour. And then when I came back to the floor, well, here's one cute little story. When I came back to the floor, well, people were happy to see me, the staff and all. And there was one agitated man, a patient there, in and out of delirium. And agitated. He said, "What's all the fuss about? What's the bother here?" So I went out to him. I said, "I'm just back here on the Jones Wing, back on the floor, after walking a donkey 1,700 miles around the coast of Ireland." He looked at me with a tear forming in his eye, and he said, "Don't worry, son. When I first came in here, I thought I was Teddy Roosevelt." So why would he believe me, right?
Yeah, right.
But when I went back, there were a lot of restraints and seclusions. Things got hard. There were a lot of hard asses, like the nurse ratchets, you know. There were a couple of them on our floor, tough nurses, you know. They should have been working in the prisons, you know. And they were very quick with the needle. So I had learned during my donkey travels that Missy, my donkey, was fabulous with racehorses, you know, that were really kind of wild and ready to go all the time. And she was also a guard, and she actually could go into a field where there'd be a racehorse or two galloping around and would settle them down by just her mere humble presence. So when I went back to the floor, after learning this, I asked Eileen Myers, a wonderful boss that I had, if I could basically become a donkey nurse, be more out with the milieu and the patients rather than inside, and just kind of keep in peace. And it really worked. And about 2 or 3 years later, we were the lowest restraints and seclusions in the entire state of Massachusetts, and we got a really nice award for it. We actually went a year and a half without having to restrain one patient. And I tell you, there were some wild stallions in our field.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
But it all came from Missy and the donkey travels, how good she was in kind of settling people down.
So how does a first-generation Irish-American who almost achieved sainthood, who walked 1,700 miles around the perimeter of Ireland, how does he celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
Well, actually, it's not too bad. I mean, in the early days, sure enough, I'd be out there, right, with my pints, you know. But there's a couple of nice pubs here. We have Patrick's Pub, and then we have the Heritage in Lennox. And lunch, probably for Belita and I, where I might have a jar or two. But in the evening, there'd be music somewhere. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, I do get readings. See, when you write a few Irish-themed books, nobody knows you except for one crunch week, and that's in the middle of March, just like yourself and your music, right?
Right, yeah.
So everybody wants a piece of you during this time. So I'm going to be quite busy again next week, starting actually on Sunday on the 15th.
Yeah, and that's why
I'll probably go till the 22nd or so.
Yeah, and that's why instead of St. Patrick's Day, why don't we have St. Patrick's Month? We should have a whole month. Right.
Well, we're getting a week. We're getting a week now, Ed.
I know.
I think a week is solidified.
Let's keep pushing for it.
Yeah.
You know. Hey, I one other story from your Lucky Irish Lad book that I just want to reflect on for a second is, and I'm really glad that this doesn't happen anymore, but trucks used to come through neighborhoods during the day and spray for mosquitoes, and it still happens in some places. We don't have it in our neighborhood in Des Moines. There are some parts of Des Moines where it does happen. But when I was a kid, they used to spray by helicopter. And I remember being coated with malathion, who knows what that stuff was, that was coming down on kids during the day while we're out playing. They're spraying the community for mosquitoes. And if I have any problems at all, I always attribute them to that experience. But you took it to another step. You actually would run behind the spray truck and make a game out of it.
Oh, kidding. It was the best time. It turned our whole neighborhood into a smokehouse. I mean, like something you'd see in, at the carnival. It was a Navy fogger. It had four thick nozzles, and it just jetted out fog. It was a mixture of xylene, DDT, and carbon dioxide. Then occasionally they would blow fire 4-foot flames from it. And as soon as it came through up the street, very slowly, it would slowly come up the street. You couldn't see your neighbor 10 feet away. That's how thick it was. We'd get on our bicycles and follow it as far as we could until we warbled into somebody's yard and basically collapsed.
So you really would feel the effects of it
That
quickly. How come you're not dead of cancer?
Gee whiz, here I am. I'm 77 next month, and I tell you, I have two great, perfect lungs. You know, who knows? See, that's because Mary came to me.
Oh, there you go. That's it. That's it. You have to give.
There's where the sink
right.
comes in.
Give thanks.
I don't brag about it anymore that I have my woman up top. You know, my dear lady. Just
give thanks to the priest with the jiggly hand.
Yeah, I know. How about it?
Yeah.
Hey, it's funny. Go ahead.
Well, we got to run to a short break here, Kevin. I really appreciate it. Join and stick around for a minute. But when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Sarah Davis. Later in the program, we will be talking about pesticides and cancer and some somewhat positive news on that front. We'll also be talking about some court rulings, some gone one way, some gone another way. But my guest this segment has been Kevin O'Hara, author of A Lucky Irish Lad, The Last of the Donkey Pilgrims, and the name of the third book, Kevin?
Ins and Outs of a Locked Ward.
Yeah, great. Hey, Kevin, thanks for joining us, folks. Thanks for tuning in to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you, back in a minute.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks again to our sponsors, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. Hey, I'd like to welcome to the program Sarah Davis. She's a podcast host. She's an instructional designer. And for a while, she's going to be a temporary nomad. So,
yes,
Sarah,
we
Kathy and I got your, can I call it a holiday card? Is that what that was?
It's New Year's
it
card.
It says Happy Year. Happy New Year. Okay. Yeah. And we love one thing you wrote on that. Well, it was all nice. But the one thing that stood out was, and I quote, "As I step into the new year and begin a new life as a temporary nomad, I'm holding one simple intention, trust in the unfolding, in the pauses, and in whatever comes next." So.
Yes.
What comes next?
Well, that's what I don't know yet.
Well, you are preparing a long walk, which always intrigues me, of course.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of long walks.
Yes. I'm preparing to walk the Camino de Santiago and the Portuguese route. So it'll be...
The Portuguese route.
Yes. Okay. About 2 weeks of walking.
Okay. How many miles?
I actually don't know exactly, but it'll be about anywhere from 12 to 20 miles a day.
Okay. And other than really tired legs, what do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah. So there's something about walking that gives you perspective and gives you the opportunity to speak with other people who have different life experiences. And
in foreign languages, in this case, maybe.
Yes.
Well, I imagine there's a lot of English on El Camino.
Oh, there's a lot of English, for sure. And yeah. Since part of that time I'll be on the Portuguese path, I don't speak Portuguese, so...
But you're learning Spanish.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I am. Yes.
Yeah. And so what do you... you've done the Camino before.
Yes.
But apparently once wasn't enough. You're going back at it.
Yeah. Yeah, so the first time I did the Camino, it was actually at a moment of transition, and I feel very similarly now. I'm in a moment of transition. And that first time, I was also going to spread my dad's ashes. So he was a longtime avid follower of the Camino, Camino everything. He talked to everybody about the Camino, but he didn't get a chance to go. So that was kind of a chance for me to connect.
So you brought him with you?
Yes.
And somehow you got his ashes through TSA?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's the easy part.
Oh, really? Okay. What's the hard part?
The hard part is finding a quiet space and a moment to be alone with the ashes, really. Because okay. I was on the popular route, the first route.
So lots of people. Okay.
Yeah.
And so what is the transition in your life this time?
Well, this time also kind of relates to parents. I'm an only child, and my mom passed away in 2024. So it's sort of a chance for me to, like, really just kind of come to terms with that transition of being from being her caregiver to being my own person again. Just kind of like caregiving really makes your life a little bit smaller. And so I'm looking for more of an expansion right now and a vision of maybe what I can do to have impact in the future.
Any thoughts preliminarily on what you can do to have an impact in the future?
Yeah, I actually really don't know. I had one idea that I'm still tossing around, and we'll see, which is to create retreats for former caregivers and have sort of a funding mechanism to allow them to be able to attend said retreats. Because a lot of times what happens when you're caregiving at the end of life, maybe if you're somebody like me, who has a job, you might quit that job to caregive, and then all of a sudden your funds are running out because the funding that is provided for you is not enough.
The funding as a caretaker is,
yeah.
Sometimes it's non-existent.
Oh, right. Yeah. Totally. Or you have to be very, very crafty and very persistent.
Yeah.
And a lot of people can't, I mean, my mom had Alzheimer's, that's 24/7 care. A lot of people can't afford that level of care. Even in a nursing home or facility.
And how many years did you provide care for?
4 years. Some of that was remote and some of that was in person.
Yeah. So that can be intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you might, I mean, one idea is to put together a retreat center where people who have come out the other end of providing long-term care can kind of get their feet back on the ground, their heads back where they need their heads to be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And because of my background in instructional design, thinking about how I can make that not just a solitary experience, like a 3-day event, but then ongoing throughout the year, where the touch points and how can we connect into the community in a meaningful way, where we're not just sort of offloading to each other, but giving back and generating new ideas.
So now, in lieu of the existing retreat center, which you may found someday, you're going on not just the trip on the Camino. You've got some other plans as well, some other undertakings that you hope will bring you some sense of purpose and peace. And I'm putting words in your brain here, so help me out if I'm off base.
That's great. You're better than ChatGPT.
Well, wow. That is the best compliment I'm ever going to get.
Yeah. I'm also, so I'll start off the trip in Spain, and I go to Spain pretty regularly now. I have a friend who lives in Madrid, so she'll be my home base. And then I'll go from Madrid to Granada, where I'll take a 2-week language immersion class. Mm. I'll go back to Madrid, and then I'll go on to the Portuguese Camino. And then after the Portuguese Camino, I'm going to go to Italy, and I'll be joining in on a dolphin research project.
Mm.
And
learning how dolphins are using ChatGPT?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, of course.
Well, everybody's doing it, right?
Yeah. Well, it'll be much more boring than that, I think.
Okay.
That would be amazing if dolphins could somehow communicate with AI. But I'll be observing dolphins, their dorsal fins, their behaviors, helping to do things like marking down what GPS location they're at.
To what purpose? What's the end goal for the dolphins?
Yeah, I think it's just ongoing research and understanding of those dolphins in that area.
In the Mediterranean dolphins?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then did you say you go to Ireland after that?
Yes. So first I will, I knew I had to take a break in the UK because I only have 90 days of Schengen.
Wait, just to be clear, Ireland is not part of the UK.
Yes, but it's it's off of Schengen.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so there's a Schengen region which dictates how many days you can be on in the area, and there's 90 days.
I still don't know what that means.
So Schengen is just a region that somebody has indicated.
Region?
In Europe.
In Europe, okay.
In Europe, where you can only stay 90 days before you have to leave.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So it's like a type of visa.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, and I'm on. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It becomes an obsession. So you can rotate off of that and stay some time, and then your days sort of overlap and you have more days.
Okay. And you're going to Ireland, to the Aran Islands, I believe you said, which is a very remote part off the coast, the west coast of Ireland. It's a very traditional area where the Irish language is still spoken primarily.
Yes.
Yeah. And what are you going to be doing?
Inishmore is where I'll be specifically.
Okay. That's the biggest of the Aran Islands, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. I will be volunteering for a bed and breakfast.
Okay. Washing dishes?
I don't know. I don't think so,
Will you be making the traditional Irish breakfast?
Do you
know what that is?
No.
Okay, well, you heard it here first, and not from ChatGPT.
Yeah.
A traditional Irish breakfast includes more meat than your digestive system can realistically handle, blood pudding, black pudding, sausage, a type of bacon called rashers, and then it includes an egg or two, brown bread, which is kind of a soda bread, regular old white bread, a half of a tomato that's grilled or fried, and a little bit of a mushroom. It's massive.
It sounds amazing.
It's very ritualistic almost.
That sounds like I could make that.
And your gastrointestinal system will not thank you. But you'll get to make it for other people.
Yes.
Maybe.
I'm
not sure if you get to do that or not, but I hope you do because it's it's probably safer to make it than to eat it.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what I will be doing. I think I'll be more of a, social welcome greeter, and then I will be doing maybe some sheet changing, and I think I'll be serving the breakfast. I don't know if I'll be making the breakfast, but that would be interesting
I
learned how to do that.
You've got an immersion program coming up in Spanish. Do you have one coming up in Irish as well?
No, so Irish will be like...
Well, and again, everybody.
Here you go. Here's Ireland.
Everybody there. Everybody in the Aran Islands will speak English as well, and the Irish language is just beautiful, by the way. And I've always regretted. I started learning it at one point, but never made it too far. But it's a beautiful language. You'll love hearing it. And I remember going to Mass in Ireland and hearing the entire service in Irish, which was great.
Wow.
But even though you're not going to learn Irish, we're coming up on St. Patrick's Week, as I call it. Any particular celebratory elements in your plans this week?
No, actually, no.
We'll have to come hear some Irish music.
Yes, you are doing some Irish
music. Me and my ne'er-do-well musician friends are playing 8 different times.
Wow, yeah. That's a lot of times.
I know. Well, it includes gigs in Harlan, Denison, Greenfield, Indianola, but the La Pièce de Résistance, can I say a French word describing an Irish event, is going to be at Mitzi's in West Des Moines.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, anyway. Well, then maybe I should put that on my list.
You absolutely should. Yeah. Anyway, so I mean, what's the end result of all this traveling, all this, some might call it navel-gazing, recovery from, I mean, again, if those, you know, my mom just passed away last year, and my sister was the primary care provider. And it was intense.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So if you do build that retreat center, I'm going to send her your way. But yes. She's doing fine, actually. Yeah. But I can see how it could be something you really need to just step back from and take a break. But what is the end goal? What is the end result?
Yeah, I think, that a lot is yet to be determined what the end result is going to be, for sure. I think it'll hopefully be more of a sense of purpose or reflection time that I've had to kind of look back on the last few years and sort of make sense of what's next. And a lot of it could be just rest.
Rest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But resting in a different environment.
Yes.
Than Johnston, Iowa.
Yes. Okay. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
But you think you'll come back to Iowa?
I'll have to come back. I'll be back at the end of 4 years, so 4 months.
4 months, okay. That's four a lot. Months. You're going to get wrinkly skin with all those dolphins, and you'll learn how to speak Irish.
Otherwise, my house sitter might, I don't know, occupy the house permanently. I don't know how that works.
Right.
But I think that a lot of it is just about taking a step back and acknowledging what happened and thinking about what's next. A huge part of watching my mom and in the caregiving journey is just seeing how short life is and wanting to really make the most of it.
And, you know, again, recognizing the difficulty, the challenge of being a caregiver as you were, as many people are, we also have to acknowledge that these are very difficult times we live in now. I've been on this planet for seven decades now, who's counting? I don't think I've ever seen a time that's more challenging than this. I know that the need for, you know, politically induced psychiatric care is way up. There's a lot of people who are really struggling right now because of what's happening with our government and our country.
Yeah.
Do you see any ways in which your experience might impact how you interact with the challenges we're facing on that front?
Yeah, I think, when I think about like what I'd like to maybe do in the future is help maybe make our country a little bit kinder to people who are caregiving. Or, I don't know, help to reflect that onto the policies that we make around caregiving and the funds that are provided around caregiving so that people who are in that situation maybe aren't so isolated and have a way to get out.
And that's a good question. What are the funds available for people in your situation who are providing care?
Yeah.
a state and national.
Yeah, I mean, I feel fortunate that I didn't have to tap into a lot of that system myself, but I did have friends who did. So at least one friend in California, she heavily relied on IHSS funds.
And that stands for?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea.
Okay, never mind.
But basically, they were funds that were set aside so she could help provide care for her father who needed 24/7 care. Mm. But she was only able to pay minimum wage to care providers. Mm. So she was still very much involved in his day-to-day care. Mm-hmm. But I believe most people think that Medicare might cover everything. And it really doesn't.
No, Medicare is... we could have a long conversation about America's healthcare system. Mm. I'm glad you're going to be spending some time in places where they have a more humane... I mean, I would say I think our care is great. Accessing it and paying for it are the problems.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Well, Sarah, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
I appreciate you inviting me. This has been really fun. Thank you.
Sarah Davis, folks, podcaster, instructional designer, and a temporary nomad. We look forward to hearing about your experiences and folks. And when we come back from a short break, I'll be covering a whole lot of other ground. We're going to be talking about some court rulings, one going against Greenpeace. One involving ICE that I'm feeling pretty good about, and one involving a company that is wagering on the apocalypse and a court ruling that we should also feel good about. Back in a minute with more conversation for you on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here. Thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, so lots happening in the legal world these days. Way more than I can cover, but three things of interest to me. First of all, Greenpeace. It's been a long time coming, but last month, a North Dakota judge, he finalized a jury award against Greenpeace. They're supposed to pay $345 million to a big oil company, Energy Transfer Partners. That's the company owned by Kelsey Warren, who's behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. Now, I'm no fan of the national nonprofit industrial complex. Some of them do good work, but they've got a corporate structure that is extremely expensive, gets a lot less done, in my opinion, than what local groups can do on a much smaller budget. And partly because, you don't have people working at a local level who are paid $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 even a year, which to me is obscene. So anyway, how this all got started was back during the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which was very prominent here in Iowa and in North Dakota, famously with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Energy Transfer sued Greenpeace and Bold Iowa, they sued us, and a couple other nonprofits. They alleged that we were, the whole thing is kind of ridiculous. It was kind of almost that we were racketeering, that we were basically impacting their ability to do the work that they were legally allowed to do. And not surprisingly, the other groups, Bold Iowa and other groups named in the lawsuit, were kind of forgotten. We were the small groups, the little stuff. Greenpeace was the big group that had all the money, so that's ETP, Energy Transfer, went after Greenpeace. And, interestingly, I was very intimately involved with that whole struggle from even way before Standing Rock began. I mean, I started my activity on behalf of that that fight started in January of 2015, shortly after I got back from the Great March for Climate Action. And it started with a 400-mile walk from southeast Iowa to northwest Iowa, following the route of the proposed pipeline at the time, meeting with landowners, others who lived along the route to understand where they were coming from and to share my concerns and to try to share, you know, what I was hearing from one farmer in one community with what another community might not have learned. Long story. But anyway, I was very involved with that whole situation. And I can tell you there were a lot of other groups that were playing a key role. Greenpeace was not one of them. Greenpeace was only minimally involved. And so that Energy Transfer should decide to sue Greenpeace, I mean, it was clearly all about the money. Now, this might bankrupt Greenpeace. I don't know. We'll see. They are going to file an appeal, of course. I wonder how much they're spending. I mean, Energy Transfer has, I mean, Kelsey Warren is one of the richest guys in the country. And he has bottomless, capacity to file lawsuits. And to be clear, this is what is often called a SLAP suit. That stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. It's a lawsuit, a type of lawsuit filed by a big company to shut people up, to basically suppress the First Amendment, to get you to go away and not bother them. And I've had other SLAP suits filed against me. They were dismissed because they're basically unfounded. There's no substance to them, but they're an attempt to get you to shut up and go away. Now, again, I wonder how much Greenpeace has had to spend fighting these. I don't know. But it's wrong. And we'll see where it goes. So the court ruling on Department of Homeland Security, I like this one. And it's almost a moot point now because Nome is out as the Ice Queen. We could have more conversation about that. But just looking at this court ruling, last week, first week of March, a federal judge blocked a Department of Homeland Security policy that was used to prevent three Congress members, all Congresswomen from Minnesota, three members of Congress from touring a detention facility in Minnesota. They showed up. They were originally going to be let in, but someone there must have called Nome or some higher authority, and they said no. Apparently, and the reason they gave was Department of Homeland Security had somewhat randomly put together a requirement that members of Congress need to provide 7 days' notice before conducting an oversight visit at a facility where immigrants are being detained, or actually, let's admit it, American citizens are being detained. Now, okay, think of how ridiculous that is. You know, even if I were to give you a two-hour warning, you might be able to clean up your act, right? But 7 days? I mean, it's ridiculous. There's no point in conducting an oversight visit if you don't have the element of surprise. And I learned that from experience as a state lawmaker when it came to Iowa prisons and private nursing homes. There was a nursing home in my district. It was about a two-mile walk to the state capitol from where I lived. And I'd heard complaints about this facility, privately owned, but funded with a lot of state money and some federal money. So because it was funded with state money, I, as a lawmaker, was allowed to pop in and visit. And one cold day, walking home from the Capitol, I said, hey, I'm going to pop in, see what I can find. And the staff was very unhappy that I was there, but they knew that they couldn't say no. And so I remember just going out and checking out the different floors where people were at. And I remember one of them, there was a bin in the hallway that as soon as I got off the elevator, it was horrible. The stench of urine-soaked sheets in the hallway in this bin, which it was overwhelming. I remember poking into some of the rooms of some of the residents, horrible conditions. I mean, it led to a deeper investigation. And, you know, when I went to prisons, the first time I went to a prison, they didn't allow me in. So I came back the very next day with a copy of the Iowa Code saying, here's where it says that I can come in and visit any prison or any prisoner at any reasonable hour. You need to let me in. I had the code right in front of me. Actually, it was the element of the code. And so they let me in. And again, I found a lot of things that needed improving at the Iowa State prisons. But my point is that this is a good ruling by the courts, because the Department of Homeland Security should have no business preventing members of Congress who oversee its funding from coming in and seeing what's going on. All right. I told you I was going to talk about three court rulings, two that I like. Here's the other one. And this is kind of incredible that this is even happening, but there's a gambling and prediction business. It's called Polymarket. And again, gambling in the U.S. is off the charts. You can bet on anything these days. It's not just like sports betting anymore. It's crazy stuff. Like, when will a nuclear bomb be detonated between now and 2027? I'm not making this up. This is an actual thing you can bet on. When will the next nuclear bomb go off? And there are people betting on this to the tune of $900,000. That's how money has been wagered on when a nuclear bomb will be dropped this year, before the turn of the year in 2027. I mean, and I guess that particular market within Polymart is called nuclear detonation by ... question mark. I mean, you have to have nothing better to do with your life. You have to have a horrible view of the universe to want to go and wager money on when a nuclear bomb will be dropped. And thankfully, there was a court ruling that said, no, you can't have wagers on that. And there was a great story in The Lever about this. That's where I learned about it. And the story the quote from The Lever that I want to share with you goes, "The debate on whether prediction markets encourage insider trading on war, death, and geopolitical violence is heating up, especially after hundreds of millions of dollars flowed into bets tied to U.S. strikes in Iran and Venezuela." Yeah, does America and perhaps the human species have a gambling problem? Well, you betcha. But again, I'm glad for the court ruling. But, you know, this whole issue of wagering on insane things like a nuclear bomb going off, we should have a deeper conversation about how much of that should even be legal. Okay. I want to talk about, switching gears, about pesticides and cancer. And this is a bad news, good news story. The bad news is that Iowa, my home state, has the fastest growing rate of cancer in the U.S. Cancer in Iowa is worse than anywhere else in the U.S. So if you're listening to this program and you're thinking, hey, maybe I'd like to move somewhere else, I'm going to guess that what I just told you, is going to be a strong disincentive for moving to Iowa. I don't blame you. You know, there are other states that have higher rates around the country. Nebraska, Illinois, Minnesota, Indiana, Kansas. Well, what do they all have in common? Let me see. Midwest, farm country, chemical applications, pesticides. Also on the list of states with a high and growing rate, West Virginia and Kentucky. So according to a publication, Investigate Midwest, America's farmers and farm workers, their families and neighbors, are being diagnosed with cancer at rates higher than the national average. So a growing body of research indicates that pesticides are partly to blame. And I wonder if the word partly will eventually be changed to mainly to blame. Again, it's hard to know, but look at the data. Look where the incidences are bad. And again, Iowa's the worst. And we probably have the highest concentration of agricultural operation anywhere in the country, here in our state. So looking at the chart that Investigate Midwest includes, most of the 500 counties with the highest pesticide use per square mile are located in the Midwest. 60% of those counties also had cancer rates higher than the national average of 460 cases per 100,000 people. And that was an analysis of data from both the U.S. Geological Survey and the National Cancer Institute. So this is a public health crisis. It's being ignored by state and federal officials. Actually, not just ignored by them, but aided by them. And one problem here in Iowa has been the unwillingness of state government to dig into the contamination of our water system. And we saw that kind of came to a head a few years ago when three counties north of Des Moines, three counties that are in the kind of the headwaters of the Raccoon River, which supplies a lot of the water for what, almost a fourth of the state's population, maybe 20% at least. Our former waterworks director, Bill Stowe, filed a lawsuit against those three counties for not doing enough to control the flow of water, meaning we have this is why we have the highest, the most expensive nitrate removal system in the country here in Iowa. It's why we have, in part, the highest cancer rate. You know, and again, I think the people most at risk are those on the front lines in the counties, in the rural areas where they're getting frequent exposure to these chemicals. But again, not only did the state not do anything about it, they decided that voluntary compliance with pollution control was the way to go. Well, you know, it's not. It's clearly not working. And good news, I told you I'd get to that. A report just out last week by the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Now, if you don't know who Harkin is, he was our former U.S. Senator, Tom Harkin. Amazing man. Great work. Strong environmentalist and also a strong advocate for sanity in rural policies. So the report out just last week shows that Iowa's voluntary approach to cleaning up our water is a failure. We knew that. But now we've got some real solid documented evidence to that effect. The report determined that regulations on fertilizers, animal feeding operations, meaning CAFOs, and agricultural drainage, among other things, those are policies that would need to be changed to improve water quality and public health in Iowa. So this report by the Harkin Institute is a follow-up to a comprehensive report done here in Polk County in central Iowa about water quality that was released last summer. So a quote from Adam Shriver, he's the Institute's Director of Wellness and Nutrition Policy. He said, quote, a set of policies that the report contains a set of policies that, if followed, would dramatically improve Iowa's waterways to protect the health of current and future generations. We'll see where it goes, but I'm pretty sure that we're not going to see action by the current state legislature because they are totally in the pocket of corporate ag. And corporate ag does not want to change. They seem to be indifferent to the reality that cancer rates are so high in the upper Midwest, indifferent to the fact that their chemicals are poisoning us. Anyway, the report is really good news because it's out there by a former U.S. senator, and it's well documented, well researched, and is presenting information that you can't ignore anymore. So going forward into the next election cycle, I think this is going to be probably the top issue in Iowa and maybe some other states as well. Hey, I got to take a short break. When we come back, Kathy Burns is going to join me. We're going to be talking about farmer mental health statistics and resources. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Hey, welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Thanks again to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, familypsychiatry.com. Well, Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
You just got back from a two-day conference on mental health and how it's affecting farmers and others living in rural Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's sad that we need to have such a deep conversation about this, but it's really, really important.
It was a training organized by the Iowa Farmers Union and presented by the Iowa State Extension staff to help about 14 of us people who are members of the Iowa Farmers Union learn more about mental health in rural communities and among farmers and the general population, and see where we could learn more tactics to help people when they're experiencing just general mental health situations or even crises.
Yeah, and the suicide rate among farmers is 3.5 times what it is the population at large, and you know there's a lot of other mental health challenges in
mm-hmm.
agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many reasons why you can be very, very stressed out very, very quickly, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of it has to do with weather and whatnot. But that's certainly not the only cause.
No, farmers face the stress of, especially if they still have the family farm, holding on to that family farm, and their what they feel they owe to the generations of farmers before them, the economic pressures that are beyond a lot of farmers' controls, especially now with different tariffs and the back and forth of what's available and what's not. And there's also a social pressure to portray that rugged individual stereotype and less access to help when farmers need it.
Yeah. So what do you think you took away from the experience in terms of how you can be an advocate for?
Well, first of all, the training was called Mental Health First Aid, mm. and one of the things they impressed upon us the most was that we're not learning how to provide counseling, how to provide medical care. Similar to how
sure.
someone goes through first aid training, like providing CPR, we're providing the steps that can help a person understand where to access help and the kind of help available.
Yeah.
So that was really important. We are not professionals in
right.
that area. We are called mental health first aiders, and we are now all certified in that area. But it's something that anybody can reach out to. In Iowa, you could reach out to the Iowa State Extension and see if they can arrange a training for your group. But the training is organized by the National Council for Mental Well-Being. It's a 501c3 based in Washington, D.C. It was important for the Iowa Farmers Union to have the trainers focus and add statistics on the effects of strains on our mental health from the agricultural aspect.
The incident of mental illness in the U.S. is on the rise. It's mm-hmm. across the spectrum.
Yes.
Correct.
The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that 1 in 5 U.S. adults live with a mental
wow.
illness. And as you mentioned, this is according to Penn State Extension, suicides are on the rise, increasing 36% from 2000 to 2021.
A 36% increase just in the last 20 years.
Yes, and that's suicides suicide attempts that result in death, not just the attempts themselves. The national suicide average is 14 per 100,000 population, but a 2020 study showed that the suicide rate for farmers and ranchers, farm managers, was 43.7 deaths per 100,000 population.
And that's deaths, not just attempts.
Deaths, not
and
attempts.
And that's consistent with a 3.5%
mm-hmm.
greater
yes.
risk of suicide among farmers than in other professions.
Right.
So it's it's disturbing.
There are resources, and that was the other main focus of our training, was to help people arrive at the understanding of resources available. So two resources for national access. There's a National Suicide and Crisis Hotline for yourself or someone you know. It's kind of like dialing 911. You dial 988.
Oh, really? Just three numbers?
988 is the National Suicide and Crisis Hotline. In Iowa, the Iowa Concern Hotline offers an amazing array of information and services. That's 800-447-1985.
800-447-1985. Mm-hmm. Kathy, thanks for attending that conference. Thanks to the entities that helped sponsor it.
Absolutely.
And if you're listening, take care of yourself. Yep. All right. Hey, thanks to my guests today, Kevin O'Hara and Sarah Davis, and to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dederman, Charles Goldman, Kathy Burns, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Happy St. Patrick's Day, folks. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.